Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. We are July 3rd, 2016. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, as always. And yet again, I'm going to talk about something that's not normally in my area of interest, but certainly is in my general sphere of knowledge. I want to talk about Donald Trump and this campaign. Now, from the Russian point of view, it's very clear. A vote for Hillary Clinton, or even had he won Bernie Sanders, is a vote for war with Russia. What's happening now concerning American foreign policy is such a blatant, deliberate provocation, you know, putting troops from the U.S. as well as from NATO in general, right on the Russian border, in the Baltics, for example, where Canada has sent 1,000 men to buttress what is called Russian aggression. No one knows what this Russian aggression is. Let me be clear. Russia has not invaded Ukraine. There was never a moment where they did this. Russia certainly would have a right to under present circumstances, but they have not. Rather, the most that has occurred is that they have sent assistance of all kinds to the breakaway republics, although confined to humanitarian aid. The Russian government has not recognized the People's Republic of the Donbass, which I think is a big problem, although Putin, of course, as always, is playing a game which he probably is going to win. What his long-term strategy is, I don't know. But he has not recognized that state or that federation. The concept, and I've written this elsewhere, the concept that Russia has invaded Ukraine comes from several incidents, 2014, where the Ukrainian army was beaten so badly by the militia of eastern Ukraine that they invented this myth that they had been invaded. It was the only way to justify the loss and the misuse of equipment and the corruption and the desertion of the Ukrainian army. The Ukrainian army has largely disintegrated the minute it came in contact with these men, partially because there's no reason for them to fight. They have no desire to fight these people. They're not going to shoot other Ukrainians, regardless of the political issues. And they're so clearly being used as a debt collection agency for the New World Order that they're certainly just simply not going to fight. Furthermore, their equipment is antiquated. There's no money for them. It is a disastrous and very actually pitiable situation. It was more specifically General Ruslan Komchak, who some time ago deserted his post. This is in August 2014 in Yelvask. He was commander of the Southern Operational Unit, and he had ordered his men to break through the positions of the separatist, the armed separatist movement. And as this occurred, he deserted his post and ran in the opposite direction. Now, he has not come clean about this. There are almost 20, far more than 20,000 legal cases opened by the Ukrainian prosecutor general against military men for desertion. But when Komchak abandoned his post and was, at least in certain circles, humiliated, he invented the concept that Russians had invaded, and this is why he had to run. And he was unaware. Now, there has never been any pictures of Russian soldiers in any great numbers in eastern Ukraine. They're not needed there. Although I will stress that they would have every right to be there, if necessary. The U.S. has no right to be there. And the U.S. has men and a military aid, money, and advisors in the country. I just wanted to stress here, using that example, that there is no Russian aggression anywhere. Russia has absolutely no interest in doing that. But the United States is consistently doing everything in its power to provoke a war with Russia. Therefore, this presidential election may actually matter. Most, you know, elections don't. But this may actually matter because you have two very clear views on the Russian situation. Trump is opposed to anti-Russian provocation. Hillary Clinton, not knowledgeable at all in foreign policy, has been told by her team that you want our media support, you want our money, you're going to start World War III. And that's been very clear. The woman doesn't know the first thing about Russia, Russian history, or foreign policy, and yet is absolutely convinced that war with Putin is absolutely necessary. And Bernie Sanders is similar, I think, less radical about it. And I bring this up only as a segue into talking about the election itself. When I was growing up in New Jersey, I was just over the border from Manhattan. New York City was a part of my life. And Donald Trump, when I was a kid, had just made it big. My father at the time had made a reference. I don't even remember the context, but he said for a man like that to take on the Jews in Manhattan in real estate and win, this man has got to be extraordinary. No, my father was not anti-Semitic at all. He wasn't anti-anything. But it struck him that this was a territory that Gentiles just never went. Not only is it highly regulated, and it would take a tremendous legal mind, not just a business mind, to operate it, but also it's an ethnic monopoly that he was capable of breaking. So he had made his peace with that many years ago. When he began his campaign here, I laughed. I had, you know, it just was a celebrity doing something. But no, the man was taken seriously. Number one, he was self-financing. Number two, he had no outside pressure on what to say and what to believe. Number three, he is very difficult to debate. And this is something that I should dwell on. Donald Trump will. You know, mop the floor with Hillary Clinton in a debate. Now, debates in the American system of government are scripted. Both sides go over the script in advance. The questions are understood in advance, and nothing is not a syllable is improvised. This needs to be very, very clear. No candidate in his right mind would go in you know, an environment where they could be provoked and say something that might be politically incorrect. So these are pageants. They say nothing. They mean nothing. They are they're jokes. The reason I don't vote, I've never voted in my life in an American election. I never will. Partially because of things like that. Partially because power isn't found in politics. In the United States, politics is found in economics. Now maybe if I could vote on who controls Northrop Grumman or Boeing, but that might be another matter. These companies have a far more direct relation to American life on a day-to-day basis than government does. Plus the fact that most government services are now privatized, so now the distinction between private and public is long gone. And that distinction we're just starting to get the literature on this and what that might mean. Trump, you know, and this is something for me to say because I've never been taken in by personalities. I'm suspicious of everybody. I don't trust any of the fact that he has gotten media attention at all, as negative as it is, as immediately has me suspicious. And yet the establishment has gone bonkers. Now, when I say establishment, I'm being very specific. I often use the word regime or ruling class. I'm referring to not just government authority, but far more importantly, economic power, both financial and otherwise, academics, media elites, journalists, people with this kind of so-called soft power, which is really in America the main means whereby this authoritarian liberal system functions. It's very crude to have a machine gun on every roof and a gulag out in North Dakota, where you stick all the dissidents. That's very crude. It's very expensive. No, it's rather to change the way people talk, what people believe, the meaning of words. The media decides not only what candidates matter and what don't. The media decides what issues are important, and even more, what the acceptable range of opinion. I remember in 1992, I was an undergraduate at the University of Hartford in Connecticut, and a friend of mine went up to support Pat Buchanan in the primaries there. Now, the Democratic frontrunner is someone you may not even have heard of before, Paul Tsongas, who had been the governor of Massachusetts. He was in remission from cancer, which he had earlier, and was very vigorous. I had a chance to meet him there. And those two, Pat Buchanan and Paul Tsongas, had won the primary. The media went crazy. I mean, they went crazy. They began accusing Pat Buchanan of wanting to create concentration camps. I think he had made two or three comments that Zionists shouldn't run U.S. foreign policy. And the American population was told that he is the literal reincarnation of Adolf Hitler. That's what I heard, not only from media elites, but my own professors in college were saying this. And I remember even David Letterman. These guys were supposed to be funny. They would break character, Letterman in particular. A few days after he won the New Hampshire primary, Letterman stepped out of character to say that the brown shirts are coming for you if Pat wins. Now, they're doing the same thing with Trump, although things are far worse now than they were in 1992. The media also went after Paul Tsongas, not because of any position that he took, but that he was a regional candidate. Being governor of Massachusetts, not well known outside of the area, they kept saying every single article on him. You know, the media usually covers these things with the same formulaic phrases, so you know it's all essentially one script. The regional candidate was mentioned in almost every discussion of him. But then he wins the Colorado primary and a bunch of others outside of New England. But that didn't stop them. They continued to say that he is nothing but a regional candidate, and Pat Buchanan will destroy America. And that's his only purpose, is to destroy. I mean, the most irrational, hysterical things were said about him. And his platform, quite frankly, is not different from Donald Trump's. But the situation has changed so radically between then and now. So this is how the media functions. It decides who will run, who will be considered serious, what issues are important. And the media will decide who is considered a viable candidate and who's not. Often, recently, the buzzword has been electable. Someone is more electable, meaning that they're more liberal, the more PC. That seems to be the code that journalists, so-called journalists, use to communicate, you know, their preferences to each other. Major media, needless to say, should never be trusted, but they don't lie outright. Major media tells half-truth. Pravda in the old Soviet Union was far better. You know, they would tell you everything about an event. They would then condemn it, you know, endlessly, but they would never lie about it. The adjectives that they would use would be, you know, tremendous and negative, you know, but they would never, you know, distort anything, really. They would tell you the truth and then say how terrible it was. In the U.S., it's half-truth. They can't simply lie to your face. I mean, they do it on occasion, but the best way to manipulate someone is to tell enough truth that you're credible, and then distort from there. And it really doesn't take much. The American population is exhausted, is depressed, is so mentally ill that manipulating them is almost effortless. Now, Donald Trump has befuddled everyone. I did not expect him to go this far. And yet his platform is a moderate one, if anyone would bother actually to read it on his site. But it is Pat Buchanan's platform from 1992. His support of Israel there is pandering. However, The reason he's saying it is because he cannot. I mean, a huge part of the Republican voter base are these evangelicals. Now, evangelicals are straight from hell. And I'm happy to report just a few days ago, the Russian Federation passed a law limiting the Western evangelical ability to proselytize. And that certainly is a legitimate issue for the state, because these are American agents. Whether they be Russian or not, they've been operating in Russia as a fifth column for the U.S. and the CIA. They want to bring Russia into the orbit of the U.S. and Israel, and therefore is a legitimate threat to the state, and therefore can be regulated. This is the case with, again, with journalists financed from billionaires who tell lies. Those newspapers should be shut down. You know, this is you know, the pen is far mightier than the sword in these cases. Now, the situation that really I did not expect to see was that the ritual denunciations, the mindless hysterical name calling from major media, from professors against Donald Trump, often, you know, accusing him of things that he's never even thought about, let alone said, is having no effect. That he won primary after primary after primary. That you even have Sanders supporters by the thousands contemplating going over to him. A huge part of it, at least in this segment of the election cycle, is that he is not taking money from the outside. Now, that will change, I believe, once he has officially secured the nomination. But for the moment, he can say whatever he wants. And furthermore, his events are private. And therefore, he has every right to remove protesters or whoever he wants. The topic of my talk today, I'm going to have a paper on this subject published very soon. These groups that are attacking Trump supporters, he has been threatened with death a thousand times, a couple of them actually credible. Protesters, and I've seen this almost in every rally now, they're coming out of the arena that Trump has rented out, and there is a gauntlet of protesters screeching obscenities and threatening them if they vote for Trump. Now, here's my point. In doing that, they are in violation of the voter intimidation laws of this country. When I first read about voter intimidation, the stress seemed to be just on election day. But there are other court cases. I want to mention a few, and these are from the civil rights era, but certainly are applicable here, that any time a group, whether it be public or private, deliberately wants to interfere with the exercise of a certain right to be politically active or to support a certain candidate, that in and of itself is a federal crime. So Wilkins versus United States, 1967, is a key case. There were a few thugs who wanted to disrupt a civil rights march in Alabama, and the majority opinion of the convicted parties, they say, quote, conspired together with each other and others, to the grand jury unknown, to injure, oppress, threaten, intimidate citizens of the U.S. in the vicinity of Selma, Montgomery, Alabama, in the exercise and enjoyment of certain rights and privileges secured to them by the Constitution and laws of the United States, end quote. Needless to say, this is precisely what is happening now. What makes it different is that these protesters are elite financed. There's no such thing as a spontaneous uprising. It's never existed in the history of humanity. There is no such thing as a spontaneous revolution. Human beings don't act like that. They don't trust each other enough to have a spontaneous anything, especially in rough times. A revolution, a violent campaign, a movement, these things have to be organized, usually from the top down. They need transportation. They need publications, hard copy. They need things like, you know, stickers and flyers. They need bail money if they get, it's actually kind of a big deal if they get arrested. They need a PR campaign. They need coordination. They need a central location from which to do all of this. So any movement that has functioned like the anti-Trump movement doesn't come from nowhere. It is financed by American elites. And this is the point here. So it's not just, and this is what makes this more alarming than the civil rights cases. There's a group called Democracy Spring. And this is a group that is sort of like, it's the Soros and company, of course, created it, financed it. But this is supposed to be the color revolution in America. Now, you have enough elite organizations saying in this country that if Trump gets elected, we'll make America ungovernable. There are certain non-white organizations. Democracy Spring is one of these. Constant protest. There's a few other groups that will say that every single thing he does, we will make a federal case out of it. Literally, we will bring him to court. We'll make it impossible for him to govern. Again, even that would fall under the prohibitions of the civil rights era cases. There's a movement that they have that Soros has created called Vote for Trump and get jumped. Now, I'm pretty sure that this isn't a good kind of jumped. This is a bad kind of jumped. I've seen these guys come out of the arena, and the gauntlet is almost like it's deliberately created. So you have voter intimidation and threats on camera 1,000 times over. Now, needless to say, they should be prosecuted as individuals under these laws and the authority that these court cases create. Not just voter intimidation, but the intimidation of any American that wants to exercise his rights in this fundamental area. And this probably needs to be reiterated. In the United States, from the Civil Rights era, it's been made clear. And they've used the 14th Amendment as their foundation. That Americans all have certain rights concerning freedom of speech and assembly. They can vote for who they want. Now, the U.S. government, for all of its flaws, has gone out of its way to make sure that be the case, including, you know, having to guard a handful of neo-Nazi protesters somewhere from the crowd wanting to kill them. You know, third parties get no media attention, but they are protected by the Constitution. The fact that they're marginalized has nothing to do with the state. That concerns that has more to do with media than anything else. They decide who's marginal and who's not. And I want to repeat this, and I'll repeat this probably for the rest of my career. Government is not the problem. In the United States, corporate capital is far more powerful than the state. Even that the definition of the state in America is really foggy these days because of privatization. But when a government or any institution requires credit, lots of it, from elite banks in order to function for more than 5 seconds, then it is not more powerful than the banks. The banks allow the U.S. government to function at all. That's just an extreme example of this. There are many other examples. It's a privatized regime. The U.S. government is simply the bodyguards of the oligarchy. And elections are a pageant. It's a game. It's a farce. It's largely for entertainment purposes, where two candidates, fight it out, and different issues get discussed. And of course, year after year, this happens in the congressional and Senate presidential elections, and nothing ever changes. The campaign rhetoric has no relation to anything once they actually get into office, and yet Americans continue to believe campaign rhetoric year after year after year, suggesting there's something wrong with them. Now, this level of violence, you guys are well aware, anyone who is not aware of this, let me quote from The Atlantic, liberal publication, and to their credit, They have been condemning this kind of violence, although for the wrong reason. Here's what they say. In San Jose on Thursday, I'm quoting from them now, a volatile crowd outside a Donald Trump rally assaulted numerous attendees. They punched a man in the face, knocking him to the ground, bloodied another man by bludgeoning the side of his head with a duffel bag, trapped a woman against a glass door, pelting her with an egg and other objects. They snatched a cap off a man's head, lighting it afire on the street soon afterward, and perpetrated other hateful acts against total strangers, with many fellow protesters cheering them on, and a brave few, fervently, pleading for nonviolence, end quote. That is American politics today. This is when a man, and Donald Trump has said nothing, yet Donald Trump's platform is extremely moderate. You know, a few years ago, it was just common sense. And I want to note right off the bat that when Donald Trump declared and made his platform public, the first people to attack him were corporate interests. It was not protesters on the street, or these were corporate entities that pulled out of his and doing any business with his firms. Macy's, for example, department store, NBC. ESPN, these were the first entities to try to divest themselves away from Donald Trump to keep him from running. Even there, you know, you have intimidation issues. There's no economic reason for this. They're trying to keep the man from running. Now, reading this hysterical reaction from corporate America, long before there was any street demonstration, my first thought was, these guys are so obsessed with and dependent upon their cheap labor that even the moderate platform that maybe the federal government might want to enforce the law and send illegals back to where they came from, which is not really going out on a limb in terms of politics. But the elites are, the ruling class is very dependent on labor from Mexico and the rest of Latin America, not merely in bringing the third world here, lowering wages, destroying any kind of solidarity, creating racial problems, but also in their own homes, in their mansions, in their summer homes, in their winter homes, in their ski resorts, are staffed with third worlders, usually illegals, that they can do with as they please. So in at least two ways, the ruling class is dependent on this kind of immigration. I also want to note that it's really a false dichotomy to discuss legal versus illegal. That's a very new distinction. There's good reason to stop immigration entirely. And I want you to ask yourself, in America, if not a single immigrant was ever admitted for the rest of our national existence, how would we suffer? And of course, the answer is absolutely not at all. We have everything we need. We have more than we need. The United States, if it were to completely wall itself off from the rest of the world, have no trade or contact at all, be the big North American North Korea, it wouldn't suffer. Because, like Russia, the U.S. is almost completely self-sufficient in everything that a country would require. Now, I'm not saying that should be done, but it's possible. Immigration isn't necessary, whether it be legal or illegal. At the very minimum, it should be only those people that benefit the U.S. in some way. Not that they have a scientific knowledge, they have literary knowledge, something like this. It doesn't really matter where they're from so much, but that they can contribute to the United States and in its development. 1964, many of you know, the immigration laws in this country were changed. It's not an accident that this is roughly around the time that American wages were at its peak. That union organization was creating a very, very strong middle class that was also working class. This was intolerable to the regime, especially as Japan and Germany were getting back on their feet again after the war. So they did two things. The capitalist ruling class wanted to flood the U.S. with low-wage workers, not just from Mexico, but from elsewhere in the world, but educated and non-educated, number one. Number two, they wanted to and develop the most radical free trade agenda so that they could invest anywhere as quickly as possible without much, without any consequences to themselves. And number three, women were then also brought into the workforce in large numbers. Now, these things all had the cumulative effect of suppressing wages, but it also had the effect not only of destroying solidarity, because now labor is so radically divided, they're not even speaking the same language, but also that workers that have jobs are now threatened all the time. They can't open their mouth because this company can leave and abandon this town and go elsewhere at any time. And if you have a diverse workforce, as they say, then uppity, especially if you're white, uppity whites can be hit with a suit that they're sexist or racist, and there his life is over. You could have no foundation. In fact, it usually doesn't, but it's over. You know who rules you when a nobody, some fourth world immigrant from Latin America, can bring a company to its knees because it goes to the federal state and complain. Now, deals have been made, and this stuff, you know, it's not like it happens every day. But it shows you the power that even now, because of this, profits are secondary to the ideology of diversity. Ultimately, this is not a rational course for them. A happy a workforce that's being treated properly, that is in labor solidarity with the owners, is the ultimate interest, long-term stability. But of course, that's not going to mean, you know, in American capitalism, it is Darwinian. This is where Darwinism came from. It's not an accident that Darwin wrote at the height of the British Empire and at the height of the British Industrial Revolution. It's not an accident. It's not a coincidence that he wrote precisely at a time when these ideologies of competition, both in terms of foreign affairs and the race for colonies and resources, as well as capitalist conglomerates fighting each other in competition, became the norm. One company comes up with a method of production that puts another company out of existence. The victorious company then takes its assets and its workers and centralizes even more power. This had developed even in early 19th century Great Britain, and Darwin just came around to justify it. It doesn't really matter that he applied it to biology. That was where it came from. It's not an accident that he was simply mirroring, and of course with the British race for colonies, you know, their system of imperialism worked. They defeated their rival Spain, and worked with Holland to create this global empire. They won the economic race in Europe, and therefore the spoils of the world. So what was music to the ears of these people to hear Darwin saying that this is how everybody is. The natural order is competitive, one destroys another, and the resources of that other then are absorbed into the victorious party. That was a wonderful way. So we're not doing anything wrong in destroying whole economies. This is how it is in nature. So they are fully justified in what they're doing. This is the reason why it was accepted. It was a stupid theory to begin with, and then the discovery of DNA after World War II made it impossible for a rational person to believe in. But it continues to exist, and because it justifies the capitalism, it justifies imperial foreign policies on the one hand, and local and domestic industrial competition on the other. It's not immoral to destroy your competitor and to centralize power and to rule as an oligarchy or even as a monopoly, because, well, I won the contest, and therefore, like everything else in nature, I am entitled to the spoils. It always made me laugh that some of these weird white nationalist people who have this, they used to be, I don't think there's any left anymore, this whole might is right stuff. They believed that they believe that races are in this perpetual warfare, and it's completely Darwinian and races function just like species in Darwin's works. And so whoever wins has every right to the spoils. And I guess it's not occurred to them that, at least as it stands now, the white race in the U.S. has lost. And therefore, the spoils rightly belong to our enemies. So the victories against us over the last 50 years are because of their superior organization or whatever it is that they, whatever it's attributed to, and therefore the elite, the Jews or whoever it is fully justified in exploiting these opportunities. There's nothing wrong with what they've done because Darwin, this interpretation of Darwin says it's perfectly okay, and everyone does it. Everything does it. This is the mentality of capitalism. And so the laws were changed in terms of immigration in 1964, flooding the American market with low-wage labor, the increasing computerization of banking and increasing a better transportation and just quicker movement of capital made international investing more and more attractive. The Export-Import Bank of the United States ensures, among other things, these foreign investments from failure or nationalization. That's really the essence of corporate welfare. My brother-in-law is one of the vice presidents of the Export-Import Bank of the United States, and he's often very loath to talk about his. He was also the best man at my wedding, actually, in 1999, and he and that's what he, you know, he's very clear about this. This is what we do. Corporations reach a point of power such that they control the state. So the Export-Import Bank and its policies don't come from the state, don't come from, you know, the Treasury Department or something. It comes from corporate America. It's like the IMF. You know, these labels, you know, the World Bank, these are just banking consortia. They're groups of bankers organizing themselves this way, and they tell their governments what to do, and they set standards for the rest of the world. And under certain circumstances, military force can be used to enforce this stuff. So, you know, these labels, these are mystifications, all of these, you know, these are just economic elites exercising their power. Now, if you're a Darwinian, it's legitimate. They have every right. They won. They should be exploiting everybody else. It's perfectly okay. World's just matter in motion anyway, so there's no morality to begin with. You know, Marx and Darwin made no moral claims. Marx never made a moral claim. He's a materialist. This is just how it is. The revolution of labor in Marx is just it's just cause and effect. There's no moral supremacy there. It's just it's what happens when exploitation becomes that severe. The pain of the organism, the proletarian organism as a natural phenomenon is so much that it can't handle it anymore, and it becomes violent. No different than a wounded animal lashing out. It's, you know, Marx made no moral claims. Darwin made no moral claims. They were materialists, and they believed so one chunk of matter is no different than another chunk of matter. It doesn't matter if it's human or not. Matter is matter. If you're going to be a materialist, this is what you have to believe, and this is at the root of industrialization. So nominalism and Darwinism are the two big centers of it. And of course, so Marxism and capitalism, yet again, are almost identical in every respect. And now with the privatization of the state, it's really, really hard to talk about the difference between public and private in this regard. The government is going to regulate X. The government has no power to regulate X. The government may be given permission to regulate a certain industry. But these laws, these bills aren't written, congressmen aren't there writing this stuff in their study. You know, corporate philanthropies and NGOs are writing these bills that congressmen and senators never read. They're usually too substantially long. And the most that happens is they get, you know, fine-tuned in committee. But that's who does the regulating, corporate capital. The U.S. federal case against Microsoft in the 90s, that was one of the pivotal moments. Microsoft defeated the Justice Department. The Justice Department cried uncle. Microsoft outspent them. They had more lawyers. They had more resources. They made a secret deal, and Microsoft did whatever it wanted. Corporate capital has always been more powerful than the state. The American government is bankrupt. The bureaucrats are overworked, and there's no way that a company like Microsoft could ever be told what to do by the U.S. government, especially since government agencies are all using Microsoft operating systems. The Justice Department lost, and it was just, I mean, this had always been the case that private capital, you know, created the state. That's not been a secret. It's just that Microsoft was a very obnoxious, symbolic situation where the power of capital, the supremacy of capital over everything was made very, very clear. The Justice Department, in other words, was told what to do in a secret deal with Microsoft. And furthermore, after that, the bailout of the banks was so transparently outrageous that there was really no distinction between public and private in that area. The state was simply the collection agency of the banks. Now, the point of saying all this is, in terms of ideological background to what's happening, in this Darwinian struggle in capitalism, the American firms require cheap labor. They require cheap labor that is complacent. Now, complacency can be bought, but division among workers is an incredible way to keep people quiet. A better way is to be able to say to them, if you ask for too much, we will simply get up and leave. If you form a union, we will leave. The dumb American will say things like, well, just be happy you have a job. You know, like a job is a gift to you. And they're just doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. This is how now labor is controlled and morale is so low, even though productivity is absolutely through the roof. But feminism, just like it was in the 1930s, was Joseph Stalin created it so that he could bring more women into the workforce. There was a labor shortage for a whole bunch of reasons in the 30s, and women needed to be drafted into the industrial army, as he called it, and so feminism was born. And it existed before then, and in the revolutionary movement between 1917 and 1925, called on time, people like that. But Stalin made it more practical. And it was the same thing in the U.S. Every leftist movement, feminism or open immigration, has a laundry list of capitalist entities that finance it. The homosexual rights movement is elite financed. Every major organization is just an extension of corporate America. The destruction of culture, the destruction of borders, the destruction of identities, and increasing the pool of labor such that the workers are getting paid almost nothing, this is the ultimate goal. This is what the New World Order is. I've dedicated my life to fighting this. The race to the bottom. Well, the race to the bottom has more than just economic consequences, but social consequences. Economists sometimes forget, and economics should never be separated from politics and philosophy. That's an artificial distinction in academia. When a man loses his job, especially if he's out of work for any length of time, it's very common for them to go into a very deep depression, beliefs that he's worthless, that he's a loser. He may even know that it's no fault of his, that this is how it is, and then his neighbors, but he'll look at someone up down the street, just bought a new car, and then he'll look over at his wife and say, gee, you must be much better off with this guy rather than me. You know, I've heard it too many times. So it's far more. We talk about these things like unemployment and you know, a small town is destroyed because a big employer moves away. There are consequences that economists don't take into consideration. And it's things like that. Families are destroyed because of this. Entire rural cultures are destroyed because labor is slightly cheaper in India than it is in rural Nebraska. So unemployment has costs. And equal to the economic cost is the psychological cost. The slow lowering of morale. And when you have third worlders and women who are brought into the workforce for the sake of whether it be lowering wages or just manipulating the system. You know, a man gets out of line, a woman could say that he's being sexist to me, and again, this man is in serious trouble. We talked in the last episode about the restraining orders and everything else. There's no proof involved there. If you get a restraining order, the man can't go to work because you work together or you work in the same building. It can't be done. This is how these things could be handled, without going through the formalities of firing someone or getting rid of someone. The issues of morale and their general outlook on the world. And when this happens chronically, especially this is happening all over rural America, and they're turning to drugs and crime as a result, economists don't understand these long-term effects on society and on the psyches of these people. The point of all of this is that the violent, vicious, inhuman assault of capitalist elites in America against Donald Trump is exposing them for what they are. Absolutely dependent on cheap labor, and they absolutely need the third world to repress wages and to divide the working class to be used against any movement that seeks to better themselves. And it didn't really occur to me until March of 2015, when Trump's Chicago rally was canceled due to threats. Now, what makes these things dicey, and this is, I don't have any predictions here, is that now Trump is the, I guess, the presumptive nominee. There's, as I'm recording this, there's no, the convention has not occurred. Trump is just a presumptive nominee. He is entitled to Secret Service protection. Trump is now not just a man, not just a millionaire. He's a symbol of the democratic process. Attacking him now is not just a crime against his person, but a federal crime of, we've mentioned these cases already, voter intimidation, harassment, the desire to coerce someone away from exercising their rights as an American citizen, whether it be as a candidate or as a voter. He is far more than, in this case, now he has changed status. Attacks on him are now federal crimes, especially now that he is essentially the nominee. I might note that recently the corporate sponsors of the Republican convention have pulled out. Several of them have removed themselves and will not finance this convention. The same corporations finance both Coca-Cola, American Express. It's a typical group of elites. They finance both conventions. And some of them, not all of them, have pulled out of the Republican one. Now, there is absolutely nothing. I mean, the only thing that can justify this kind of a childish, a screeching that started in the corporate boardroom and then from the corporate boardroom financing the street thugs is that Trump will begin this avalanche that will take away their cheap labor. They could bring in third worlders who are deeply alienated against Americans, who've been told that Americans are evil. You don't need to speak English. And urban police departments have seen their budgets slashed. Their numbers fallen less than half over the last 15 years. They are absolutely incapable of handling the crimes. People say that the crime rate is down. I say you're an idiot. Cops can't pursue crimes anymore. In Detroit, I think I mentioned this before, the northeast part of the city is controlled entirely by gangs, non-white gangs. And this was made clear to the world just as budget cuts forced the police department to disband its anti-gang unit. What Trump is saying is it takes about 5 seconds to verify. The violence in American gangs is exclusively non-white. This is simply a fact of life. You could scream, you could try to kill me. There's nothing you could do about this. It doesn't change the fact that gang violence and the drugs that they peddle, that these gangs are hundreds of thousands they're motivated, they're well off, they're powerful, they have an army of lawyers, that these are organized forces, that they're very, very well armed, they could take on a police department with no problem by themselves, let alone in combination. There are no white gangs. It doesn't exist. And Trump isn't even talking about this, but he is talking about what illegal immigration is doing to the country, both in terms of social life, of crime, and economics. It is the simplest thing, very easy to verify. Now, this so-called Democracy Spring has part of their manifesto reads like this, quote, "Today we are calling for a massive nonviolent mobilization of working people, students, immigrants, the children of immigrants, great-great-grandchildren of immigrants, people of color and white people, the unemployed and underemployed, people of faith, retirees, veterans, women and men, anyone who opposes bigotry and hate and loves freedom and justice, to stand up to Trump's bullying and bigotry," end quote. Now, this is not, you know, this was written in a corporate boardroom. This was written at an elite NGO meeting, you know, in Aspen, Colorado, or a place like that. This is not from the streets. What makes this, you know, blatant, overt violation of federal law different from in the civil rights era? That these Klan guys, or whatever they were back then, that were trying to keep black people from voting, they were at war with the federal government. They were at war with corporate America. Corporate America had always backed integration and that kind of thing. These guys were acting alone and received long prison sentences because they were interfering with an American's enjoyment of rights. And in that case, they were correct to be so prosecuted. Our position on these things are right. We don't need the state to back that up. We don't need to coerce anybody. We'll shred anyone in debate, which is why we're hardly ever debated. However, Trump is not even using this kind of terminology. I don't know who he's bullied, since he's the one who's always being bullied. If you go to Google and you put in a search term like death threats against Trump, it will come up with nothing but allegations that Trump people have threatened others with death. The algorithm has clearly been manipulated to avoid that issue. The point is, you have elite sponsorship of these acts of violence. You have elite sponsorship of this movement that says they will make America ungovernable if Trump is elected. There is elite sponsorship of these gauntlets. These people don't get to these protest sites just on their own. They don't walk there. This is organized. There's a legal structure to it. It's not that hard to discover. But Western people, for some reason, are of the opinion that the only institution that can oppress someone is the government. And in America, the government is a private entity. And it's a tool for one corporation to use against others. The coercive authority comes from the financing of elite money. These protesters, I don't know if they're directly paid. I mean, some of them have admitted that they've received money. I always used to say they should unionize. Maybe they should get overtime and health insurance. But that's not even the point. The point is that these organizations are financed by the same corporate interests who benefit from mass illegal immigration and who, if their lives aren't privatized enough, live in gated communities, meaning that they are surrounded by walls, which is something that Trump is being condemned for. It's always made me laugh. Surrounded by walls and patrolled by armed and unarmed private security. So when corporate America uses these groups and uses this kind of violence to talk about diversity, or we're going to end sexism, it's meaningless. The white people in these corporations have no sense of identity. But everybody else has a very intense, false and made up, but still a very intense sense of themselves. And nationalism is perfectly okay so long as you're non-white or non-Christian. La Raza, which is a racial organization, which is what that phrase means, has the following financiers. And this is just a brief list. AT&T, Bank of America, Chevron, General Motors, McDonald's, Time Warner, Shell, and Walmart. There are a whole bunch of others, but that's just a handful. So here you have an anti-white, racialist, Mexican nationalist organization promoting unlimited immigration and the colonization of the southern part of America into the greater Mexico of the nonsense, being financed by corporate elites. So it's rational that you say that these movements are, in fact, extensions of corporations. I mean, there's still enough respect for law that your corporation simply can't have private security go in and shut down a rally. Now, what they need instead is to hire thugs to make it seem like this is a spontaneous protest. And none of these things are ever spontaneous, nor could there be under these circumstances. Donald Trump is extremely popular and would be far more so if the elites weren't condemning him in every phrase and every word. The most important thing, though, is that they're in violation of federal law on numerous levels. Even more, they're in violation of State Department policy in terms of judging foreign elections. So when an election is condemned, which usually means the wrong candidate has been elected, in places like Russia or Belarus, the State Department has their own standards from which to decide whether something is good or something is bad. The Institute for Democracy has this Electoral Security Best Practices Guide. And some of the things they condemn and what makes a election cycle illegitimate, it includes things like, and this is their words, quote, hate speech, defacing campaign posters, disrupting campaign events, intimidation of voters, end quote. So these are just some of the ingredients that would invalidate an election. An election is not valid if it exists in what they call this climate of intimidation. Now, that's precisely what some of these very same people have created with the Trump campaign. So we have two things. We have the Donald Trump, anti-Trump protesters, number one, being in violation of federal law. That would include things like the Price decision, as well as voter intimidation laws, blatantly and on camera. And number two, they're in violation of basic State Department protocols as to what would be a legitimate or an illegitimate election. Now, given the fact that Trump supporters have been violently threatened now for months, the election has already been invalidated. You know, it really doesn't matter who wins or who doesn't. You know, if Trump wins, he would have won by far more. The point is they're trying to keep as many people home as possible. They may be very scrupulous to avoid open coercion on election day, because that's where most of the laws are aimed at. But a climate of intimidation has clearly been maintained. Donald Trump will be polling, when you read a poll, he's probably about 10 points higher because a lot of people won't admit that they're Trump supporters. Just that by itself intimidates voters, frightens people, and it renders this election invalid. Those two entities, and then they're kind of joined together by the fact that this is elite money financing this. Now, chances are nothing will happen. This violation of federal law will be just ignored, and the state will yet again just admit that it's completely lawless. I suppose that now it's true that Barack Obama has condemned this violence, you know, reluctantly, but he has. Could he possibly be forced somehow to prosecute these people for intimidation? He can't do so if they're corporate elites. But he might. Someone might. Donald Trump needs to take these people to court and show that they are in violation of that they're in violation of keeping Americans from the most basic, even in their Republican system, the most basic rights of political participation. The system is rotten. This is American politics now. And this is all by design. The Third World was meant to be imported to the U.S. so they could act like this. They could be used as a reserve army. As individuals, these are not bad people. I've lived with them. I know them very well. I have a tendency to get along with non-whites better than I do whites. But the fact remains that as political organizations and en masse, they are simply tools of the regime to use against whites who get too uppity. This election has already been invalidated. There's no moral or legal validity to this election, as Trump voters have been intimidated really beyond reason. Whatever happens, what the American mind will do with all of this, that is another matter. So I thank you for listening. I want to thank my friends who have supported me, as well as my enemies. You're idiots. You're pretentious. You don't know. But I do appreciate you keeping me on my toes. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.